Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So Donald Trump is in all the headlines, but Democrats are also confronting their future. And for one, that future will be decided on November 30th. Representative Tim Ryan from Ohio has until that day to try to gather the votes to overthrow House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, his former mentor, who's led the House Democrats for 14 years. So how's that effort going, and what does he think his party has to do? Representative Ryan joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
And you've said the moment for you when you realized that you needed to step in and challenge Nancy Pelosi was when your own county, which Obama won by 23 points, went to Donald Trump. What did you think in that moment?
Well, it was an earthquake that came through the industrial Midwest. And, you know, a lot of us, I think, understood at some level, we kind of get in denial sometimes during campaigns, but that we really weren't connecting with working class voters. White working class, black working class, brown working class, men, women, we weren't connecting with people. And so my average median income in my district is $57,000 a year, which means, you know, two parents working jobs making less than 30 grand a year.
Yeah.
And they don't have a home in the Democratic Party now, and we need to get them back if we're going to be a national party.
Well, that is a narrative that has emerged. There's also the thinking that the Democrats had a flawed candidate, but also that Democrats have become too much about identity politics, concerns, you know, for blacks in the inner city or Hispanic immigrants or the transgender community. Do you agree that the party has become too sort of balkanized?
I agree. Yeah, you know, we talk to groups of people, sliced off groups of the electorate, interest groups, and there's no energy in that. There's no juice in that. Where juice comes is when there's a unifying message of all of the things that we all agree on, that we all stand for. And that's today an economic message for all Americans about growth and opportunity, whether you're a millennial or you're a 55-year-old working-class person in a place like Youngstown, Ohio. Let's talk about jobs and wages and secure pensions. Those are the things that people are thinking about. And as a party, if we're going to unify, you unify behind that message, and that message drives everything else. You want to talk about gun violence in the inner cities? That's an economic issue. Our long-term, you know, projected deficits and our long-term debt, that's an issue of economics. You got to grow the economy to bring the debt down. So it all gets back to that unifying message.
There are Democrats we've spoken with who don't buy the narrative that this election means that the Democrats weren't listening. They feel that President Obama brought the economy back from disaster, that he increased jobs, but that a lot of the ideas that he wanted to implement, which Donald Trump is also talking about, infrastructure, for instance, he couldn't because of the Republicans in Congress. That the Democratic Party was not that tone deaf.
Well, you know, you got to look at the scoreboard, and the scoreboard says we got wiped out. We are not a national party right now. We are a coastal party, and that is a minority party. And if someone is delusional enough to think that somehow it wasn't our fault, that we did everything right, and these people in Michigan and Minnesota and Wisconsin and Ohio, you know, didn't quite understand us, that's the exact problem we need to get away from. And look, no one's even taken responsibility for what's happened. And I'm saying, look, we have a standard in our party. You have to win, or you have to let someone else take over. And it's not personal, but I got kids. I got kids growing up in a Donald Trump world. And I am not going to stand around and let people tell me that it was the voters' fault. They didn't quite understand us. That's wrong. These people want help. They want someone advocating for them. They feel like we've ignored them, and in many ways we have. And I've told my colleagues this. If I don't get us back into the majority in 2 years, in 2018, you won't have to have a vote. I'll leave. I think there should be one standard in this party, and that's winning. My community needs the Democratic Party to be a strong party, and if I can't do it, I'll step aside and let someone else do it. But we've got to make some changes. We've got to make them now. And if we don't field a great crop of people and we don't change what we're doing, we're going to be in a permanent minority party for a long, long time.
That's Tim Ryan, former quarterback and the Democratic U.S. rep from Ohio, challenging longtime leader Nancy Pelosi to become minority leader in the House. Congressman Ryan, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Out west in Colorado, contractors are shelving projects because they can't hire enough construction workers. The industry's labor shortage is a problem across the country, and it comes at a time when Donald Trump has promised to put people to work with a $1 trillion infrastructure plan. Michael Gifford is CEO of the Associated General Contractors of Colorado. He's on the line from Denver. And Michael, does Trump's plan make sense to you?
Well, I think if you look at it from the macro level, it's a great observation that, you know, we really built a lot of our modern infrastructure back in the 50s. And if you count, that's like, if I do my math right, that's over 60 years old, heading towards 70 years old. And so whether it's underground and you can't see it, like a water or sewer system, or it's above ground, like a road or a bridge, I think Americans intrinsically know that we need to rebuild that to remain a strong and powerful economy.
And good for your businesses like the ones you advocate for.
It will be, because things are all connected. Buildings operate with a water line and a sewer line and a power line and an internet line and a road. It would be very good for the construction industry, and we'll need to get ramped up if that plan's going to come into place, and we're hopeful that it does.
Yeah, and you've got an interesting perspective there where you are in Colorado. It's a relatively new state. It's growing fast. What kind of investment would you sort of be on your wish list in Colorado there if this plan were to be able to go forward?
So, you know, we've had about a $7 billion investment in one of the largest light rail and commuter rail systems, a transit system in the country. So we're pretty good. We're opening four lines this year, but our roads are past capacity, so we need to do some widening there, both Interstate 70 and Interstate 25, and then water storage as well, because we've got a growing population. So that would be your dams and your conveyance systems for water. So it's more the roads, bridges, and the water and sewer.
It's an interesting time to be having this conversation, because the construction industry in your state is having some pretty significant challenges. You're in the midst of a major worker shortage. What's going on there? How bad is it?
So if you go back to 2007 to get some perspective, we had about 176,000 construction workers in the state. Then we had what we call the Great Recession, and we had about a 40% drop. And so we've added 60,000 plus employees over the last 5 years, about a 10% growth rate. And now we're at the point where we physically are building everything that we can build, and we're employing a number of different techniques to get more employees and also be more productive.
Are contractors having a hard time getting people to job sites, though? And what does that mean for timelines? I mean, are projects getting delayed, that sort of thing?
You know, we have a really good conversation with every owner about what a timeline would be. So some will decide to delay their project. Some will decide to pay for overtime. Doing more offsite modular construction in warehouses in different parts of the country that have a lower or a higher unemployment rate, and then shipping things in, we're employing all those things. Mm-hmm. But yes, in some cases, we are having delayed schedules. We could build more projects if we had more people, although we have a couple new recruitment programs that are really bearing some fruit. And we're spending about $1 million this year on recruiting employees we brought on staff, and then also internet ads, billboards, buses, light rail. You can hardly escape our ads asking you to go to buildcolorado.com if you're in Denver.
Sure. And all of these adjustments, these changes that you're making, drive up the price of construction.
They do. So construction costs have gone up quite a bit. And so some projects, you know, fall by the wayside, at least temporarily, when you have that spike in costs, especially real-time labor costs.
Well, look, a nationwide problem. I'm looking at a survey from August that was put out by the National Associated General Contractors, the group you're affiliated with there in Denver. It says that two-thirds of contractors across the country are having a hard time filling hourly construction jobs. So my question to you is, let's say Trump does invest big in infrastructure over the next couple of years. Will we have the workforce to pull it off?
Here's the truth is, if you're going to do infrastructure, what we learned from past efforts is not everything is quote unquote shovel ready. Owners don't just design things and put them on the shelf when they have no hopes of funding them. And so if we come in with a big infrastructure plan, there will be a kind of design blueprint, if you will, type of period to get things ready to build. And that's the time that we'll be even doubling down on our efforts to get more individuals into the construction industry. But, you know, we spent 30 years getting to the point that we are, you know, removing the industrial arts or a shop from the high school classes, and those are starting to come back. But, you know, we're not going to catch up all of that at once. So we're doing a lot of other things to recruit people that are underemployed. That's really the main strategy right now. There are people to do the work, but we're going to have to recruit them from other places where they may be making minimum wage right now, and recruit them and then train them on the job for these projects. So it'll be a challenge. You know, the question is, for the overall economy, will there be enough workers to serve all the industries? And that's, you know, that's probably a separate question.
Michael Gifford is the president and CEO of the Associated General Contractors of Colorado. Michael, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
President-elect Donald Trump is being called on to disavow the white nationalist group, the National Policy Institute, which held a conference blocks from the White House this past weekend. The Institute's president, Richard B. Spencer, claims to have coined the phrase alt-right to describe white nationalist, white supremacist, racist, misogynist, and anti-Semitic groups. Here's an excerpt from his keynote.
America was, until this past generation, a white country designed for ourselves and our posterity. It is our creation. It is our inheritance, and it belongs to us.
Well, Spencer got stiff-armed Nazi salutes from the crowd at that moment, and later when he praised the president-elect.
Hail Trump! Hail our people! Hail victory!
Well, arms were also raised before that speech on Friday when the National Policy Institute, NPI, held a banquet at the Italian restaurant chain Maggiano's Little Italy in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Pictures showed people at the banquet making Sieg Heil Nazi salutes. Protesters then came into the restaurant and forced it to close. Well, Maggiano's first issued a statement apologizing for closing, blaming it on the protesters' disruption, saying the restaurant serves all people, from the Obama's daughter's birthday party to a Trump breakfast meeting to a private dinner for Bernie Sanders. Then they issued another apology for inadvertently hosting a hateful Nazi event. Steve Provo is president of Maggiano's Little Italy. He joins us now. And Steve, this has been a difficult week for your chain, but do you think maybe you missed the mark in that first apology by not first denouncing the group that caused the protest?
I think we did, Robin. I think the thing to keep in mind is this reservation was made very last minute on Friday afternoon, and it was the organization did not identify itself as NPI. In fact, it identified itself as a family reunion. And even Friday night when protesters arrived, it was pretty chaotic. We had no idea exactly what they were protesting. The banquet had been a pretty normal banquet like the thousands we host every year. The next morning after we posted that first post explaining that we welcome everyone, we happened to see that awful tweet with the guests making a Heil Hitler salute. And that really, really offended us. Keep in mind, in the restaurant business like Maggiano's, we welcome guests of every culture and creed and economic background. We host Korean first birthdays and bar mitzvahs and first communion parties. And our teammates hail from every country around the world. We have leaders in our company from the Philippines and in India and in Mexico. And so for us, that image was really deeply offensive.
But what would you have done had you known it was a white supremacist group?
I honestly don't know. We never, when we take a reservation, we don't ask for people's political background. And like I said, there was nothing in that event as it was going on that was extraordinary in any way until the protesters arrived. If we had known in advance that it was white supremacist, we would have simply said that that's not consistent with our values. But we didn't, and so we did what we do well, and then we had to react to it.
Well, we could be entering some interesting territory in Washington, D.C. You know, at that conference, Richard Spencer celebrated the victory of Donald Trump as the victory of will. That's a reference to the Nazi propaganda film. And Donald Trump's chief strategist, Steve Bannon, was the head of Breitbart and proudly proclaimed that his was a platform for the alt-right, which includes this group. Would you ban a Steve Bannon?
I don't know. Robin, honestly, I'm not a politician. I'm a restaurant person. I know how to make marinara sauce and make guests feel special. My biggest takeaway from the last 3 days is that this country desperately needs to bring people to sit down together around a table and to talk and have fun, which is what restaurants like Maggiano's do. Anything beyond that, I mean, that's not what we do for a business or a living. And we would hope to still be able to welcome Democratic groups and Republican groups and hope that this is just an aberration that's occurring and that our action to donate the proceeds of this event, once we found out what this group really was, to the Anti-Defamation League, makes the statement to our guests that we were as offended by those photos as anyone.
Yeah. I happen to know a group of largely African-American high schoolers from the Cambridge, Massachusetts area who were in your restaurant the week before for their field trip to Washington, D.C. You know, are you thinking about those kinds of tourists maybe sitting right next to somebody raising a Nazi salute?
Yeah, no, it's really offensive and really awful. And like I say, we embrace and welcome everyone. I mean, the coolest thing about Maggiano's, if you've ever worked in a scratch kitchen, you've got a dishwasher from Ethiopia, you've got a line cook from the Philippines, and you've got the prep cook from Mexico. You have to suspend all biases. And people work together for one common cause. And so we found really offensive the photos and the Heil Hitler salutes that were going on. And that's why we took the extraordinary action we did of closing down the restaurant and then making that donation to the ADL. I hope we never get in that situation again. But we are in an unusual place as a country right now.
Steve Provo, president of Maggiano's Little Italy. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
So, as we just heard, there are people in this country who have white nationalist or anti-Semitic views. But what drives a small number of those people to commit a hate crime? The FBI reports the rate of hate crimes grew 7% in the U.S. in 2015, including a 67% increase in crimes against Muslim Americans. Andrew Schneider from Here and Now contributor Houston Public Media reports.
Jack Levin grew up in Houston during the days of Jim Crow. He's now co-director of the Brudnick Center on Conflict and Violence at Northeastern University. He sees two major reasons people commit hate crimes. The first is what he calls thrill-seeking.
Other guys might go out to play a game of cards or go drinking in a bar, but these guys will go out because they are looking to be violent.
A prime example of this took place 3 years ago just west of Houston.
The plan is to see if I were to hit a black person, would this be nationally televised?
Conrad Alvin Barrett was driving through Katy, Texas in November 2013. He stopped when he saw an elderly black man named Roy Coleman. The sound is from a video Barrett took on his cell phone, later released to the media.
How you doing? Yeah? Knockout.
With one punch, Barrett broke Coleman's jaw in two places and knocked out three of his teeth. He was arrested and pled guilty to violating the Federal Hate Crimes Act. He's currently serving a six-year prison sentence. Again, Jack Levin of Northeastern University.
These are people who feel a profound sense of their own powerlessness, and they're desperate to feel important, special, like big shots.
But there's another type of attack, which Levin calls defensive hate crime, and this too boils down to power.
The perpetrator may feel that the enemy is here. The enemy is responsible for his feeling that he's unsafe, that he may be a victim of terrorism, that he can't find a job, that his culture and religion are being impaired.
Such defensive hate crimes have become far more common since 9/11, but the ideology behind them has long been a draw for organized hate groups. Christian Piccolini of Chicago had a dramatic introduction when he was just 14.
I was standing in an alley smoking a joint, and a 1968 Firebird came roaring down the alley, spitting up gravel and rocks and dust, and it screeched to a halt about 6 inches from me. And this man with a shaved head and boots walked up to me.
The man turned out to be Clark Martell, one of America's most notorious neo-Nazi skinheads.
He grabbed the joint out of my mouth, crushed it with his boot, and he said, "Don't you know that that's what the Jews and the communists want you to do to keep you docile and maintain control of you?"
Piccolini says he didn't know what communism was, didn't know any Jews, but he did know what it was like to be bullied, to feel weak, and Martell told him he could be strong.
My neighborhood was changing. I did start to see families that weren't Italian or weren't white moving in, and that fed into the fear that they instilled in me.
Piccolini joined Martell's group, ultimately succeeding Martell as leader. But after years of violence, he began to question his ideology and ultimately left the White Power movement. Since then, he's co-founded Life After Hate, an organization that helps others like him to leave hate groups and rebuild their lives. Membership in hate groups has plunged since the 1980s. People no longer need to join up to find others who share their views. It's much easier to do so on social media. Piccolini says that, plus the presidential election, has helped to spread such ideas into the mainstream.
I was at Donald Trump's rally in Chicago, the one that was canceled supposedly because of the violent protesters, of which there really weren't any. But I heard more vile things come out of people's mouths that looked like our doctors, our mechanics, our nurses, our lawyers, than I heard at any Klan rally or any of the dozens of neo-Nazi skinhead rallies that I've ever been to.
Trump blamed the violence at the Chicago event, which took place in March, on activists linked to Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. That said, more than 700 hate crimes and related cases of harassment took place around the country in the week after Trump's election, according to reports collected by the Southern Poverty Law Center. For Here and Now, I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Not all ingredients are created equal. Blue Apron sources fresh, high-quality ingredients and sends them right to your home in pre-measured packages. You get easy-to-follow recipes so you can have a meal ready in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
On Thursday, add this to your list of reasons to be grateful. Your Thanksgiving meal won't cost as much as it did last year. Marilyn Giwax is a senior business editor at NPR. And Marilyn, tell us, Thanksgiving will be cheaper.
Yes, that's what the American Farm Bureau Federation is showing in its annual price survey. For 31 years, it's been doing this. They get volunteer shoppers to go around the country. They look at all the different prices, and they use a really traditional Thanksgiving meal with enough for 10 people. And here's what they serve.
Mm-hmm.
Turkey,
okay.
Bread stuffing,
yeah.
Sweet potatoes, good so far,
mm-hmm.
Rolls, butter, cranberries, a veggie tray, pumpkin pie, whipped cream, coffee, and milk.
So, and tell us what they found, because it looks like a dinner for 10 came out to just under $50. Last year, it was just over $50. Not a big difference, really.
That's right. But it's down, and, you know, that's good. Anytime prices fall, it's kind of good for shoppers. And the big change this year, really what caused that drop was the 30-cent per turkey drop for that's a 16-pound turkey. And also, milk is down. Milk's at the lowest level since 2009.
Really, Marilyn, do we know what's causing that?
Well, there are lots of different factors, but really there's just been overproduction. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics, they compile a consumer price index. So overall, the CPI, the consumer price index, is up 1.6% for the past year, but food itself has really been depressed.
Okay, so it is good news. It's a little bit cheaper than last year, but I'm looking at that $50 number for a Thanksgiving meal for 10 people. It does sound low. I know everybody's on a different budget. Don't most of us spend more for Thanksgiving?
Yes, we are Americans, so
yeah.
We will also buy ice cream and apple pie and chocolates, and I'll want to get a bottle of wine. And all of that does drive up that price, but that's what's good about this 1986 traditional thing, because you can actually compare a sweet potato to a sweet potato. There's no trends in all of that. So you can see actually when you compare this over time, food prices have held really steady over the last 30 years. If you adjust it for inflation, they really haven't gone up. But it's fair to mention, too, that over that same period of time, wages haven't gone up.
Yeah. But Marilyn, I bet if you asked people if they felt like their grocery bills are higher than normal, they would find it hard to believe that food isn't more expensive these days.
Well, Peter, I think we have to look at our waistlines for that one. You know,
no,
the truth
please.
Is, don't look down. The truth is that over the last three decades, people have been eating more. We really aren't eating the same things we were eating in 1986. So when you really look at statistics about what we weigh, in the mid-1980s, the average man was 181 pounds. Now the average is 196 pounds. So we do... what we call a feast now is just bigger than what we used to call a feast. But there's something else in here that's kind of interesting about why you might feel like you're spending too much. The Natural Resources Defense Council says that this year we'll probably throw away more than 200 million pounds of turkey because people also just sort of overspend. We buy too much. So they're encouraging people to just really plan that menu and cut back. Just buy a little less and go for a little more of a walk.
Marilyn, you started with some good news here about the price of food, and then we took a turn for the worst, unfortunately. Marilyn Giwax, Talking Turkey, Senior Business Editor with NPR. Thanks, Marilyn.
You're welcome.
Yesterday, police arrested 16 people in North Dakota who were protesting the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. On Sunday night, police used tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse protesters and water cannon them despite the freezing cold weather. Nearly 20 were taken to the hospital early Monday. Members of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe have had an awakening. They say the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline will endanger their waterways and destroy historical burial grounds. They may not win in the end. The pipeline company has expressed hope that under President Trump, they will go forward. But meanwhile, there's another awakening, another preservation effort going on. Chef Sean Sherman, or the Sioux Chef, S-I-O-U-X, grew up on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, and he's trying to preserve traditional Native American cuisine and bring it to the world. He's a member of the Oglala Lakota Sioux. He joins us from Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Sean, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
How did this start for you? Talk about growing up on the Pine Ridge Reservation, one of the largest and one of the most impoverished, not really eating the food of your forefathers.
Right. You know, lots of wide open spaces, lots of plains. We kind of bordered the Badlands in South Dakota. And, you know, we grew up kind of running around, playing outdoors a lot. And we didn't really have restaurants. We had one grocery store in the town of Pine Ridge itself. So we'd spent a lot of time hunting and kind of running around being free. We were probably a little feral.
Well, thankfully, foraging for berries and things like that. And I say thankfully because there was such poverty, so little industry, that there was a lot of government food.
Yep, lots of the government cheese and canned salmon and canned beef and, you know, canned generic everything, basically.
Spam.
Right,
Spam.
Right. Spam. You know, later in life, when I kind of had the epiphany of focusing on my own culture and heritage as a chef, I really did have to dig backwards and try to figure out what that meant, because there was a lot of missing information as to what really was Native American food. And we had bits and pieces of it growing up, but I knew there was a lot more to it. So we did have the choke cherries, and we did have things like the wild timsala, which is a prairie turnip. And, you know, there's lots of wild onion and, you know, there was a lot of flavors out there in the wild game. But I just knew that there was so much more to it.
Well, in fact, do I understand, there are certain foods you will not eat now because it was part of the government food that you had?
Well, you know, for the work that we're doing and focusing on pre-reservation, pre-European foods for North America, we've cut out ingredients that weren't here before. So we've cut out wheat flour and dairy and processed sugar, even beef, pork, and chicken.
And so what are you cooking?
Well, you know, proteins are easy because we have all of this wild game. So we use a lot of venison and rabbit and bison, turkey and quail, lots of the freshwater fish around us, so lots of walleye and trout, northerns, whitefish, things like that. And then the bigger piece for us was really getting an education on the plant life, so the ethnobotany and the agricultural scene that was happening. So looking at all the heirloom indigenous seed varieties that people were growing, and also plants that people were collecting, and using all of those flavors on the plates that we're creating.
And when you say people, you've been called the second generation of Native American trying to find these foods.
Yeah, there's been a lot of great work out there. I've learned a lot from some of the ethnobotanists out there, a lot from the elders who still know and practice a lot of these pieces in the different reservations.
So this all culminates in things like the Indian taco.
Well, for our food truck here in Minneapolis called Tatanka Truck, we did a take on Indian tacos, which was typically fry bread with kind of Tex-Mex flavored meat and beans and lettuce and sour cream, called an indigenous taco.
It's what the more modern Native American came up with, using things like wheat flour that they wouldn't have used 150 years ago.
Right. You know, fry bread, it doesn't take too long to figure out where that starts from. Really, it's just, you know, what the government was giving Native American people to survive off after they started moving around to reservations. So staples like flour and lard and sugar and salt, there's not a lot you can do with that, especially if you don't have any ovens, but make a simple fried dough. And hence, that's where fry bread comes from.
So a nod to the more modern indigenous taco, but you also do a more indigenous taco.
We just wanted to do something that was more health-based, so we did a corn base instead of a fry bread, where we basically just grill a corn cake, almost like a grilled polenta, and then we top it with whatever. We have rabbit, we have bison, we have turkey, we have beans and squash. Since we're not using any dairy in anything, everything's pretty much plant-based if it doesn't have the meat particularly on it. And we use a lot of wild flavor, so we gather a lot of wild herbs during the summertime. And we top it off with wojapi, which is just the berry sauce.
Things like toasted sunflower, pumpkin, squash seeds, that's a part of it.
Yeah, we like to top off with a little bit of the seeds and nuts for a little bit of texture, too.
Yeah. Wojapi, what is that?
So growing up on Pine Ridge, we had a sauce called wojapi, which was traditionally choke cherry. So we would collect the choke cherries in the late summer. And then I can remember my grandmother making, you know, huge pots of it on the stove. And that was pretty typical for a lot of Lakota families. But wojapi really, in the simplest form, is just a berry sauce. So you can use pretty much any berry you want to.
And you cook it down.
Yeah, we just cook it down, and you know, we don't bother thickening it. I've seen a lot of modern recipes where they add sugar or cornstarch, but we just kind of let it go down until it gets thickened on its own.
Put it on tacos, put it on ice cream.
And it's good on everything.
Yeah. What, you know, what does it do for you? We were just visiting with the Chickasaw in Oklahoma for a story about saving an endangered language, and we were lucky enough to have a meal there. And I am in love now with wild grape dumplings. They were just so good. And yet, in this case, it wasn't the season for the, you know, those wild grapes that you can find out in the woods. So they were using Welch's, but that's okay.
Sure.
But what's it like to bite into something and know that that's actually, you know, your food? Maybe I'm reaching here, but can you feel something when you bite into something that you know your ancestors might have eaten?
Yeah, and we see it all the time because we go to a lot of these tribal communities and we'll do these foods that are just very simple, the indigenous foods of that region. And it's fun to watch people's faces and see all of these memories get pulled out and this kind of ancestral memory coming out of the food and just, you know, really affecting people in such a positive way. And you can feel it. It's just, you know, good, clean, and great energy food.
Well, and there's another purpose here. We talk about the history of the reservations when you say they were given the government-issued food when they had to move. Well, these were forced marches. And it just seems as if many of the Native peoples have not recovered. There's a huge incidence of, well, alcoholism, diabetes, heart disease. Is part of this about eating better?
Yes, because the indigenous diet just happens to be such a healthy diet. You know, it's low glycemic, it's high in vegetation, it's low salt, it's good fats, lots of seeds and nuts, lots of really healthy proteins. So it's great that the indigenous diet itself was so healthy because, you know, before European influence, there was very little things like the type 2 diabetes and obesity and heart disease and hypertension and even tooth decay. So by bringing back a lot of these traditional flavors and getting people with the mindset of wanting to have these traditional foods more often on their tables, we can really directly take on a lot of those foodborne illnesses just through traditional food.
Where do you see this going for you? You've got this successful Tatanka truck, the food truck, and your catering company, the Sioux Chef, S-I-O-U-X. Mm-hmm. You also want to build a brick-and-mortar restaurant, maybe put out a cookbook. Maybe there's the TV show down the road. I mean, do you see Americans finally turning back to their real Native American food?
Well, I think that the food that we're doing and really getting people to open up and understand and respect the indigenous background of this country, it really helps re-identify what American food is. You know, instead of just being hamburger and Coca-Cola for the United States or poutine for Canada, it's really more regionally specific. You know, cause if there were Native American restaurants that were culturally and regionally appropriate all over the United States and Canada, people would really see that huge diversity of all these awesome some food and flavors and culture that we have. And you don't have to be from indigenous background to appreciate and respect those pieces that are just part of our landscape.
Meantime, what will you be eating Thanksgiving?
Well, we like to eat, you know, just extremely local. You know, Thanksgiving really is a harvest dinner, and then we just like to appreciate the foods that we grew that year and a lot of the flavors that we collected and just spend, you know, that time with friends and family.
Well, there you are in Minnesota. Now, I'm betting there will be some local wild rice on your Thanksgiving table.
Definitely. We use tons of the hand-harvested wild rice from the native tribes around here. We use a lot of maple. We work with a couple of native farms around the area, so we like to use a lot of produce from them and just a lot of the game that grows naturally around here.
Yeah. Sean Sherman, the Sioux Chef. Sean, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And I'm looking at his recipe for maple glazed roasted acorn squash with toasted pepitas. Those are pumpkin seeds. Also, cedar maple tea. You can soak your tree, your cedar, and make tea. Looks delicious. It's here now.
A couple of stories we're following today. About 250 pilots for a cargo airline have gone on strike in Ohio, just as the holiday shopping season swings into high gear. ABX Air flies packages for Amazon and DHL. The union representing the pilots says ABX hasn't had enough pilots to make deliveries, and as a result, pilots have been getting emergency assignments and aren't able to take time off. Now, Amazon says it's confident it can deliver its packages on time because it uses many carriers, but DHL says there may be some delays. And at the White House today, President Obama honors 21 people with the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Honorees include icons from the world of sports, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Michael Jordan, singers Bruce Springsteen and Diana Ross, and philanthropists Bill and Melinda Gates. The president said the honorees helped push America forward and inspired millions of people around the world. He's also set the record for the most medals of freedom given out. And finally, it's the time of year when auction houses hold their fall sales, and they are off to a strong start. Christie's auctioned off a work by Willem de Kooning for $66 million last week, and Monet's Grain Stack, it sold for $81 million at auction. Art experts say predictions of a softening art market after the election have so far turned out to be premature. But there's an auction happening tomorrow at Sotheby's in London that is a bit different. It comes from the collection of two of Britain's best-loved 20th-century artists, Mary Fedden and her husband, Julian Trevelyan. The proceeds will go toward preserving the storied West London Wharf, where the couple lived and worked, for a new generation of artists. Vicky Barker reports.
For more than half a century, this complex of small warehouses on the River Thames was a magnet for some of the greatest names in art, science, and literature.
Dylan Thomas used to come and stay.
Inside, in the dusty sunlight of a now empty Durham Wharf, Julian Trevelyan's son, Philip, bends over a massive, bulging scrapbook.
It's an extraordinary scrapbook. There's Bertrand Russell with Mary.
Philip's stepmother, Mary Fedden, recorded everything in this book, from the epic parties, Hollywood star James Mason once crashed one, to the minutiae of the couple's daily life, working in their studios or puttering in their garden.
The nice thing about this studio is you go straight into the garden.
It's a garden Josie Manzer remembers well. She's a former correspondent for Interiors magazine and was the couple's friend and biographer.
A pretty garden, rather crumbly buildings, but warmth and generosity beyond belief. and successful art. I mean, good art coming out of it.
Julian Trevelyan drew inspiration from the world around him, including the sailboats and swans and bridges and barges that shimmered outside the windows here. Mary Fedden's primary focus was still lifes, celebrating everyday objects in jewel-like colors, playing with perspective so that jugs, flowers, and bowls seem to dance in the air. Robin Caudron Stewart is a modern art expert at Sotheby's.
They were both obsessive artists. They loved what they painted. They loved what they did. Painting and printmaking for Julian and Mary, it was in their blood.
They also loved cats, which were leitmotifs in both artists' work. Pat Lusada was a friend and neighbor. She remembers Fedden keeping a big, shallow metal bowl.
And she used to put one of her cats in the bowl and put a hat on it and turn it around and have all of these enchanting verses that she sang. My name is Mr. Pooster.
A very English eccentricity infuses much of Fedden and Trevelyan's work, says Robin Caudron Stewart.
Wonderfully quirky, and I say quirky in a good way, sort of very English, eclectically English.
One reason, he says, for their enduring popularity here. Pat Lusada says that after Trevelyan's death in 1988, Fedden threw herself into her work.
They just poured out of her, and they're all wonderful.
As the years passed, Fedden's work in particular commanded ever higher prices, though it took her a long time to accept that. Josie Manzer recalls that for many years, Fedden insisted on charging only what ordinary people could afford.
She was selling lovely little paintings for about £15. I can remember going to a gallery in Aldborough, and there were paintings of hers selling for up to £30,000.
Though both artists had family money, the couple lived only on what their art brought in, using much of their inherited wealth to help other artists and art institutions. It's a tradition Philip Trevelyan wants to honour.
This is where Mary and Julian worked. Here's his old palette, well used, covered in oil paint.
Mary Fedden died in 2012. Now Philip wants to convert Durham Wharf into live-work studios for artists in residence. He's determined that this haven on the Thames remain a place where the arts are nurtured and celebrated.
Good morning.
For NPR News, I'm Vicky Barker in London.